The Tarncast, Tarncast. 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 This is the Tarncast, Tarncast. The Tarncast, the Tarncast.
Hi. Welcome to the Tarncast. It's back. The Tarncast is back. I'm very special guest Todd Robert Anderson returning to the Tarncast after a 2-month hiatus. I needed a lot of time to recover from the last Tarncast, which was just a curveball and unbelievably emotionally crushing. And I just needed, some time off. All right, that's not true. What's true is it was summertime, and my kid and my wife were out of school for the summer, and it becomes very hard to find time to sit down and talk to myself with a microphone recording my voice talking to myself. So, in this triumphant return of the Tarncast, by the way, the other thing I thought about saying was that I was on strike for 2 months, waiting for somebody, anybody to say, hey, are you still, when's the next Tarncast? There hasn't been a Tarncast. And for 2 months, that didn't happen. And then on my YouTube account, I do this stupid thing called The Web Show of Todd on YouTube, which you can subscribe to. And every now and again, a little 3 to 5 minute video of me talking about absolutely nothing will pop up in your email. So I highly recommend subscribing to that on YouTube. You can go to my channel, Todd Robert Anderson, on YouTube and subscribe. But I got a comment on the last web show, which was also right before school let out for summer. He said, excellent reading. I don't even remember what the web show was about, but apparently the reading I did was excellent. And he said, hey, are you still doing the Tarncast, or are you working on something new? And the answer is, obviously, I wasn't doing a Tarncast, nor was I working on something new. But it was nice to get the comment and hear, hey, there is one guy who listens to the Tarncast, and he's wondering if you're going to do it again. It wasn't really a call to do it again. It wasn't, hey, I'm dying to hear another Tarncast. It was just sort of like, I don't know, maybe he apathetically listens to it, wondering, you know, if it's ever really going to take off. So he can say, hey, I listened to the Tarncast when nobody listened to it. I was Tarncast before Tarncast was cool. But that dream of his, I don't know. I don't know if it's going to work out. So, I'm relaunching the Tarncast. We'll call this season 2, even though there's no real delineation of any specific time when I do it. I just do it when I can. It's filling time in between auditions and jobs, and you know, I do it like kind of saying to myself, well, it keeps me creatively in tune, and it gives me something to do, and it's a good hobby for an entertainer to have. More truthfully, I do it out of guilt, and you know, I pay for a site to host it. So if I'm paying monthly things and I'm not doing it, then it's just kind of a waste of money. Well, not really. I guess it's a bank, so people can go back and they can experience the old episodes when it started and the sound was lousy and I couldn't figure things out, but now I have lightly figured things out as much as I need to in this cheap home version of podcasting setup that I have. But I thought I'd do this. This is sort of like an essay. You know how you come back from when you're in school, you know, remember school? Or maybe you're in school and you're listening to this, which you shouldn't because it says it's explicit. I could drop a fuck or a shit or a cunt bag at any time. And if you're a kid, you're like, oh no. And if you're listening to it out loud and your parents hear, they're like, what the fuck is that, you little asshole? Why are you listening to that crap? Who's this Todd Robert Anderson? What's he doing to your brain? He's ruining you with his yammer. He's not even... His conversations are one-sided and directionless at you. So stop it. And he curses. What the fuck are you doing with yourself, young man or woman? Anywho, I'm gonna, you know, you get back from school, you know, and from the summer, and they want you all with in elementary school, you know, and sometimes junior high, they want you to do an essay about what you did over the summer. So I'm gonna tell you what I did over the summer. Obviously, the last Toncast was very short and involved my son, and he was very silly. And I was silly, and my wife got mad at me because I didn't yes and him at one point. I just pointed out that it wasn't making any sense, and she's like, "That's not good yes anding." So I got spanked by my wife verbally, not physically. I prefer the physical spankings; I get more out of that. But the verbal ones are, you know, I guess more lessons are learned that way in this modern times. So that happened, and that wasn't my intention to end, a Toncast show and go into hiatus with a little weird thing, but that's just how it worked out, because then my family was home, and we had like a couple weeks where we were just kind of getting it together, work was kind of slow for me, because, you know, it always is in June. Because when school lets out in LA, you know, all business sort of stops because everybody goes on their ludicrous, you know, 2-month vacations in Hawaii. You know, the successful people and the not successful people go back and visit their families. So that's what we did. We went back east. And I'm not saying I'm not successful. I am successful for a guy who's not famous. And maybe that's the best thing, because I can do things, you know, under the radar that most people can't do. I can say I only have 345 followers on Twitter, so I can pretty much say whatever I want, you know, and it won't get me in that much trouble. I could be Mel Gibson, anti-Semitic and racist and misogynistic on my Twitter feed, and not like a couple friends would be mad at me, but that would be it. It wouldn't have a lot of impact on my career. So that's the upside of not being famous, is you can be horribly racist and homophobic and all these things. I don't really take advantage of that, because I'm not that way, but it's nice to know that if, you know, I ever lost my mind and became some sort of crazy, you know, tea party or openly racist person, that, you know, I could, it's an option that's open to me. But once you're famous, you know, you do that stuff and the media will come down on you and everyone comes down on you, but that's not me. So if I ever lose my stuff and I focus all my energy on unnecessary hatred, I have that's an option that I have open to me. So silver lining, you guys. So we went back east, and, you know, we planned it like the last week. We went back for 2 weeks, which, you know, when you're talking about family vacation and crashing with your family, it's probably not cool for your family to crash for 2 weeks, but it just worked out that way with it, you know, airfares and all that stuff and how expensive it can be, and trying to save money on nonstop flights because we got our little kid, our 7-year-old kid, and we're not doing, you know, the 3 legs, you know, 3 different planes to get across the country in 47 hours and all that stuff to save money, because it's just too difficult. So the cheapest way to get nonstop flights was to fly on certain days. So it wound up being 2 weeks. So we overstayed our welcome, and probably, you know, as soon as we left, my parents went, "Oh my God, so glad they're gone. There were so many children." And then, you know, my brother came up with his family, and my sister was out a lot with their family, and I had friends with their kids, and there were a lot of kids, and my parents, you know, they're retired, they're older, they like, that many little kids around, it's exhausting. Kids are exhausting. Even if you don't like you're not the primary caregiver, you're just sort of a, you know, off to the side helping out here and there, but, you know, they would disappear. they would just leave their, they would abandon their own home and leave us there for, you know, a 6-7 hour period just so they could have a vacation from our vacation. Poor people. But they live in a little town called Walpole, New Hampshire. It's where Ken Burns, the documentarian, lives. He has a nice little house. It's not little at all. It's pretty big. It's a lot of land, woodsy and quiet and nice. And there's a little chocolate shop in town called Burdick's with this fancy chocolate that my son was obsessed with because he loves chocolate. So we did that. We had planned it for that time of year, end of June, beginning of July, because it's usually really nice. It's before the summer really takes off and becomes horribly humid. But as it turns out, the summer took off early and it was really humid. I mean, it was, you couldn't do anything. You just sat there, and I had full intention of like jogging and getting exercise, and I got out there a couple times and did some exercise, but for the most part it was just too humid. It's like living in a bowl of soup. It's not conducive to action of any kind. You just kind of sit around and you pet the poor dog who's like panting ludicrously because it's miserably hot. They have a golden retriever, and then my sister's got one of those Bernies mountain dogs, Burners they call them, big old thing, got its eye scratched out by a cat, so it's only got one eye, not good with the depth perception, you know, bumps into stuff. and they also have a golden retriever, so there were a lot of dogs. My son was happy there were dogs. It was hot, but we went swimming in a lake, went back to this place called, Baker's Grove in Westminster, Mass. It's a place that I grew up, going to in the summers. Wonderful. It's called a pond, because it's not that deep, but it's a really big pond. So it looks like a lake at the base of, Wachusett Mountain. It's very pretty. So we did some swimming. My son had a good time swimming. And then there's, you know, mussels in the water, like freshwater mussels that he would find. And it was the most exciting thing in the world. And then shiny rocks and all that. So that was, we did that. And my aunt, on our way out, it was our last day there. And we went back to the lake for one more swim in the lake before heading back to L.A., and my aunt said I didn't smile enough. She said I didn't smile, and that came out of nowhere, and I was like, I'm sorry. It's funny. I get paid by commercial entities to smile a lot. So I guess when I'm on vacation, I go more into neutral mode. Also with the humidity, I am a chronic pain sufferer. I have this persistent daily headache, they call it. It's always a headache, and it gets really bad when the weather changes, and I think going from the dry heat to the horrible humidity really did a number. My head was throbbing pretty much the whole time I was there, so I was doing my best. You know, I was having a good time anyway, which is sort of the state of my life with this chronic headache, is to have a good time anyway. But sometimes it's entirely too brutal to, you know, laugh and smile. But I was laughing and smiling, but apparently not when my aunt was in my presence. I never smiled around my aunt. Deeply sorry about that, aunt. But, you know, what do you want from me? I was on vacation. When I'm on vacation, I'm glum because I get paid to be happy. You know, they give Oscars to actors who cry and stuff, but you try being happy for 12 straight hours, just smiling and being happy about a wireless service or a tool or something. And, you know, that can be kind of taxing. It's hard to maintain a smile for 12 hours. It doesn't seem, but I mean, how often do you really smile? I mean, do you go through your whole day smiling? You get tired. You get tired smiling all the time. You need to slip back into neutral. Be honest with yourself. Life sucks a lot, so you gotta be honest. Stop your smile all the time smiling. So anyway, we did that. Went back east and it was fun. I saw my old buddy Darren Buck, who I've talked about on this podcast before. I talked about his music. And his family came up the last couple days we were there. We went to a swimming hole in the woods, which was nice. The water was very cold, but it was cool. It was a beautiful stream. The sun glinted off the water. It was nice. We had a picnic, and there were bugs. And so that was fun. I smiled a lot when he was around because he's funny. He laughed. We laughed. And his kids are funny. And, you know, growing up, my mom, you know, if you make my mom laugh hard enough, she tears up. She cries because she laughs so hard. And whenever we're having dinners, you know, it sort of becomes a contest about who can make her break the first, who can make my mom cry. It sounds awful, but, you know, she's laughing so hard she's crying. We're not being mean and making her cry. And this particular time, Darren's daughter, Carly, she told a silly joke, and it got my mom laughing so hard she cried. My son was super jealous. He tried to get on the bandwagon, but, you know, it was the levee had already broken, so there was no making her cry again. I was a little jealous too, but, you know, little kids make her laugh the hardest when they, you know, because kids say the darndest things. That's what Bill Cosby said. I've heard in behind the scenes that Bill Cosby, he doesn't care, actually care for kids. He doesn't. I've heard he's mean. He's a mean old fella. I don't know. That's just what I hear. I grew up in Bill Cosby. Love that guy. So watch Ghost Dad while we were back. We watched some movies on my vacation, an odd assortment of films, one of which was Ghost Dad, which I don't think I'd ever seen before because it was sort of, you know, a family film when I was an older kid. Maybe I was even in college. I was late high school or early college that movie came out. And so I didn't watch it because I wasn't into family films. I wanted to see things where people were having sex and getting shot and stuff. But now that I got a kid, you know, we're searching for mildly entertaining family films that we can enjoy as much as the kid. I don't know, Ghost Dad didn't 100% fit the bill, but there were some moments of Bill Cosby mugging that I gotta say I laughed pretty hard because they were so weird. He was really kind of at the height of his TV fame and trying to do movies, you know, and he had done movies back in the 70s, but it had been a while, and he was doing family films now instead of those Sidney Poitier type of weird shows. Actually, I think Poitier directed Ghost Dad, if I'm not crazy. So, you know, it sounds awful, and it kind of is awful, but it was a lot better than I expected to be. That's my review of Ghost Dad. And if you got to watch something with a kid, I guess you could do worse than Ghost Dad. Although it kind of had an odd message that death is not final. I don't know how healthy that is. Because, you know, Bill Cosby's a ghost and then he comes back. I don't know. It was like sort of, he wasn't really a ghost. I mean, I guess he was a ghost, but it was more an astral projection movie. But astral projected dad, that title didn't test well, so they went with Ghost Dad. It was just easier, you know, to understand, I guess. But a lot of interesting messages about spirituality and parenthood and being a single dad. No, not that none of what I just said is true. It's really stupid, but kind of amusing. So, yeah, no, I'm not recommending it to anyone unless you have kids and an hour and a half and you just kind of want them to shut up for 90 minutes and have something that you can like kind of look at a magazine and look up at every now and then and kind of chuckle at Bill Cosby being a goofball. There, that's Ghost Dad. Other movies I saw other movies, especially when my buddy Darren was in town, because he likes, you know, bad horror movies. And my wife and I love bad horror movies. So we watched a couple, the first of which was, golly, I'm blanking on the name already. It had Sid Haig in it, and it was about a crocodile man in the swamp, and these teenage kids went into this, I think it was called Creature or something, I don't know, something like that. Maybe it was called Creature. That sounds good. It was called Creature. Let's say it was Creature, and it was an alligator man who lived in the swamps in Florida, and this weird community that was built around the crocodile man, and they'd sacrifice, you know, children to the crocodile man, but in this particular instance, because these kids were in the swamp, these teens, I guess there were 20 somethings really, but you know, kids, young people behaving poorly with the sex and the drugs and the rock and roll and all that. And the alligator man was hungry, and Sid Haig and his creepy cousins or whatever they were, you know, tied up the one of the girls or something, cut her leg off to get the crocodile man to come and eat her so they could sacrifice, the teenagers didn't have to sacrifice their own brethren this time for the thing, for the alligator man. It was kind of gory, really kind of like slow in parts, but it, you know, if you want to watch a movie about a crocodile man, or maybe it was an alligator man, I don't know, I guess yeah, alligator probably, because it's Floridian, so I guess he was an alligator man, not a crocodile man. So, note to independent horror filmmakers, there's still a need of a crocodile man movie, because that was an alligator man movie. So, anyway, it wasn't good on any level, but we laughed a lot at how stupid it was. And then another night we watched Hatchet 3, and my friends hadn't seen Hatchet 1 or 2. And they were worried that they wouldn't be able to follow the thread of the story. And I said, I don't think you're going to have much trouble. Hatchet 3 is, Hatchet 1 is about these people who take it's another swamp movie. Both of our, which kind of makes sense because it was super humid, and to watch a swamp movie when it's really humid out, I don't know, it just fit well. You know, you really get in, it's like feel-a-rama. It's like you're in the swamp with the swamp people. But so we're watching the Hatchet 1, they go on a swamp tour, and there's a bunch of they're looking for alligators, and it's a haunted swamp tour, so they're looking at haunted things, and there's like a place part of the swamp where this guy Victor Crowley, who was I guess mentally challenged, he was like inbred, like his parents were brother and sister, and he's inbred. And then he's taken care of by like his uncle or some damn thing. I can't remember. But anyway, Kane Hodder plays his dad, and Kane Hodder also plays Victor Crowley, the deformed monster of the swamp. And because of a fire, you know, they set fire to his cabin and killed him. But he didn't die. He's still mad. So if people go walking around in the swamp, and then they'll get hatcheted. And the gore is over the top, very, very silly. It's a kind of a horror comedy of sorts. I enjoyed the Hatchet 1, and Hatchet 2 was amusing, and it has that girl, I can't remember her name all of a sudden. She was like the little girl in the Halloween 4 and 5. And she was the little girl in The Last Boy Scout. And then she was in Rob Zombie's remake of Halloween, and she was naked and got all bloody, and it was really kind of disturbing. Denise Harris, that's her name, Denise Harris. She's just grown up to be sort of a indie movie scream queen, and she's been naked and stuff. She's highly sexualized in her movies now, as opposed to when she was a child. And it's sort of weird, because I grew up watching her as a child in all these movies that I liked, and now she's grown up and sexualized, and I'm old, and I feel weird about it. But anyway, Hatchet 3 sort of picked up where Hatchet 2 left off, and she's in that one, and Hatchet 3 as well. And there's a lot of ludicrous gore, and we liked that one, even though, you know, it was stupid. It was a better swamp horror show than the one with the alligator man. So if you like gory, stupid horror comedy shows that don't take themselves seriously, Hatchet 3 is kind of fun. Hatchet 1 is the best, I think, of the three, but the sequels are amusing enough if you like that sort of thing. If you don't like that sort of thing, stay away from it. They're very particular, these horror slasher shows. They're for people who like that crap. They're not for anybody else. And that's sort of what I like about the horror genre in general. Because, you know, it's unapologetic, and it's for a limited audience. That's why they're low budget, and they're not big budget. And, yeah, That's why it's fun. It's almost as if it's a tight-knit community and you feel kind of special as a horror fan. You feel like the filmmakers are catering something more directly to you than they are to mainstream America. So that's fun. I recommend becoming a horror fan if you're not one. But a lot of people that I know like can't watch horror because it grosses them out or freaks them out and they get depressed about humanity. And I don't really look at it that way, but I certainly can understand why you would feel that way if you do and why you think horror fans are weird. But there are a lot of weird people in the world, and everybody thinks that if you're different, like if you like horror movie, that more movies, it doesn't mean you want actual serial killers running around. You like that visceral sort of, it's a release of visceral nonsense. For me, it's usually laughing at and ludicrous gore. I mean, I sort of watch them in that level from a comedic standpoint, because there's a lot of comedy in horror if you really look at it. And comedy, I think, could benefit from, like, the best comedies to me are always independently driven comedies, you know, like a Wanderlust or Wet Hot American Summer by David Wayne there, or you know, Win-Win was a good dramedy, you know, like smaller comedies that are aimed for smaller audiences tend to be a lot funnier to me because that I'm the audience they're aiming it for, as opposed to the more wide-reaching Hangover 2s and 3s, which I don't find as amusing because they're going after a much larger demographic, and I find that comedy is better when it's smaller and going after a smaller demographic. So if you're an indie comedy filmmaker, rest assured that I'm a part of your audience and your audience exists, and don't be tempted by all the money to make, you know, something with, I don't know, Sandra Bullock that millions and millions of people, gazillions of people will see, as opposed to just a few million of your little movie. But, you know, that's I'm getting off track here. I'm trying to tell you what I did over the summer. The other thing that was interesting over that vacation is we brought all these screeners that I've had, some of them for years, from the SAG Awards. The SAG, you know, has their award show, and I'm a voting SAG member, so they send me as screeners. I generally don't tell them because they might stop sending me screeners that I'll leave on the shelf to gather dust for years. But, you know, drama's not my thing. I'm not a big fan of dramas. Like a drama, you know, when you talk about, like, I can watch a terrible horror movie because it's in my wheelhouse. And even if I'm like, well, that was awful or boring or whatever, I'd rather have wasted my time on that than like a drama that aggravates me. You know, like Million Dollar Baby was a movie that everybody loved and it won all these awards. And I could not stand that movie. It was predictable and, you know, not poorly made or anything, but it's not me. And people, drama is the main Academy Award genre. And people think that that's the most important genre. But there are so many celebrated dramas that are kind of, you know, formulaic and not that interesting. So because it's not my genre, I tend to put off watching even the ones that people tell me that I'll like. So we brought a bunch of these back with us and we watched, got to a few of them. And one of which was from a couple of 3 years ago. It's called The King's Speech. And it's about that stuttering king who has to send England into war with Hitler. I liked it. I thought it was well done. I thought it was too long. I thought it was about a 90-minute picture stretched into 2 hours, because there was a half hour of it where here and there it became like really repetitive. You know, I get that they've become friends, even though one's a king and one's a poor crazy speech coach, but after a while, you know, I kind of, my mind wandered, but ultimately I thought it was very good and certainly very touching in parts, and you know, I cried a little bit. The other movie we watched that we had a screener of was Moneyball, which I watched with my wife. My parents watched King's Speech with us and they liked it a lot. But they didn't want to watch Moneyball because my mom's not into baseball movies and my dad the only baseball movie he likes is Field of Dreams. I don't care for that one. I'm more of a Bull Durham, Major League kind of guy. I like The Rookie. That's a good one. So I watched it just because, you know, I had heard it was great and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, I'll give it a shot. It's curious because it's more about the business of baseball than it is the game of baseball. And I was like, how are they going to make that touching or relevant on any level? And I actually really liked Moneyball. I thought it was really good. I thought Brad Pitt was pretty great. I thought Jonah Hill was gave this amazing performance. And Jonah Hill is fine, you know, comedy. I enjoy Jonah Hill here and there, but, you know, maybe he's a bit overexposed comedically. But he was really good in this supporting role and funny when it needed to be and touching when it needed to be. And I liked Moneyball. So there you go. I watched a couple of dramas and expanded my horizons and became more cultured over my break by watching these movies in the extreme humidity. So that was the movies over the break. And then when we got back here, it was kind of nice. We had, I guess, 4 weeks when we got back before my wife had to go back to school. And we had a week hanging out with my kid, bringing him to swim lessons and stuff. It was still a little slow for me audition-wise. But then my son went to camp. He went to a day camp. He loved it. We put him in a day camp last year, and he didn't care for it. And it wasn't a very good camp, and that's what it comes down to. But this camp was more expensive, as it turns out. Money buys you better things. It can. In some cases, you know, when you're talking about, you know, a Starbucks coffee costing you $5 versus a cup of coffee you make for a quarter at home, I prefer the home coffee. I think people are suckers as far as Starbucks is concerned. But when it comes to day camps for your kid, more money means better day camp. He had like an awesome day camp. They had like laser tag and one of those giant tube water slides. And they had magicians coming and teaching them magic. And they played capture the flag. And everybody was exuberant and happy. All the counselors are happy and fun. So he had a good time, and that gave, of course, you know, I wound up getting a lot of auditions. I got a couple commercial jobs. I did a 1 day guest star on Robin Williams' new show, which, I played a guy in a commercial. So even theatrically, I'm in commercials. It's kind of a horrifying state. But you know what? I'm making my peace with the concept that I probably will make most of my money in commercials for the rest of my life, because I was actually on a commercial last week and there was a stage dad there, and I usually avoid stage parents, but the stage dad and stage mom, well, the stage mom was ludicrously attractive in a Playboy model kind of way. She was like middle-aged, and I don't want to say she had work done, but it sure looked like she did. She was very, it seemed like she was enhanced. But she was very sweet and nice to talk to, and easy on the eye. Something to look at. Let's just put it that way. She was something to look at. I don't think I'd ever be comfortable making out with someone like that. I would feel like I am too regular to be making out with you. But it's not, doesn't matter, because she's married and has kids, and so am I. So it didn't, you know, there was no onset romance. I don't want you to get the wrong idea. She's just easy on the eye. But she was like, they were pleasant. But the guy, who was a really good looking guy, kind of, you know, just a kind of chiseled, handsome looking dude. And he had that like boisterous, like guys like that, you expect them to have like a boisterous frat personality. And he did sort of have that frat boy, old aging frat boy thing. But he was very funny. But he said, you know, he had given up completely. And I've heard this before on commercial sets where guys have just given up theatrically because they're middle aged and they're like, I'm a commercial guy. This is how I make my money. This is it. Which is a crazy way of living. What keeps me going in commercials is what is probably the false hope of one day, you know, having a more formidable career as at least a character actor, if not, you know, a comedic lead or something somewhere. But, you know, there are old guys who hit it, you know. I mean, if you're a stand-up comedy guy and you're middle-aged, you always look to Rodney Dangerfield. He didn't hit till he was in his 60s. And if you're an actor, you kind of have to go back further to, I don't know, Boris Karloff, who didn't play Frankenstein till he was 49 years old. So, you know, those are the things that give you hope. It's dicey. The hope is limited, but it's still a hope. And, you know, to hell with it. I still do short films and web series and all that stuff. So, you know, I'm certainly an actor, even though I make most of my money saying very little and appearing in commercials. And that's fine. It's the way it is. It's not that easy to break into showbiz. I'm a guy. I am an actor. I'm a professional actor. I sort of fly low. I fly under the guys who fly under the radar is pretty much where I'm at. But that's okay. And it's good. Like I said, I have all these options open to me that famous people don't have. There is a certain level of imprisonment in that sort of public life that I don't have. So I can do crazy things that most famous people can't do. And because I'm an actor and in this weird life, I do crazy things that normal people don't do. So I'm having my fun and I'm experiencing life. I'm not Hunter S. Thompson crazy, but I'm sort of taking a page from him. I'm paraphrasing, but he quoted, life is not about living as long as you can and being healthy and being looking really good when you cross that finish line and they lay you in that coffin. It's about like limping across the finish line and spinning out and your body just collapses from all the craziness and nonsense that you've done in your life. And I'm sort of doing that in a lower key level than Hunter S. Thompson because hard drugs scare me. And I don't have that kind of stamina. I can't do that. So I'm like a low level mellow version of that. That's what I'm telling you. But that's, you know, that's the way I'm living my life. But anyway, this guy on the commercial set was, you know, saying that he's done like with the dream. And for me, really, the dream, it propels me forward. I got to keep working. I can't just be some commercial guy. I don't know what he probably works out a lot. And I don't know what he does with his days. Probably has some kind of side business where he does something online or whatever. But, you know, good for him for accepting his career path in that way. 'Cause it's very stressful to, in middle age, maintain your dream and your goals and just trying to make things happen. But anyway, so I did all those jobs. So a lot of my summer was those jobs. And then hanging out with my wife, we took a trip, an overnight trip to Palm Springs together just to hang out and chill. My son slept over at the grandparents' house. And that was nice. It was good. It was just one night. But because we haven't had like a real, I mean, once you have a kid, you don't have couple vacations that last a week. But that one night was awesome and special and it felt like when we got back, we were both more relaxed and chilled. And it felt like we'd spent a week away together, just reconnecting and bonding and all that stuff. And that's an important thing to do with your wife. And we have sort of made this packed together to have more adventures together, with the boy too, but also just together, just hanging out, going places we haven't been, even if they're just day trips or whatever, just getting out and seeing things. 'Cause it's easy to be a homebody. And when you're a teacher and a commercial actor, you know, stretching the dollar is tricky, but we're finding ways of having adventures on a limited budget. And that's that's important for a marriage, and that's important for us. And we love hanging out and just watching movies together too. So it all works out. So that we did that, and I'm trying to think what else I did. Just working, of course, doing the Film Pigs web series. I've done that. I had a lot of fun guests. The other thing I did, I had to actually, after being back in LA only for a couple of weeks, my grandmother, who was 99 years old, passed away. So I had to go back east in August. And of course, I got back east. And this time, to save money, because it was a last minute thing, of course, is I wound up on, I had two connections going both ways. So I was on three planes to get out there and then three planes to get back. The trip back was an unbelievable nightmare of delays, and it just took forever. It was a drag because I was hoping to be back in time for dinner so I could see my family. I wound up not getting home till midnight, and it was just a drag. But that's air travel. That's how it works. Maybe it was better a long time ago. I don't know. But it just always seems that in most trips I take, something is wonky and something is a pain in the ass. I went back for the funeral, and I wound up eulogizing my grandmother. Her husband, my grandfather, I had done his eulogy, and a lot of my family members wanted to be part of the eulogy, and I was kind of hoping one of them would do it. But they decided across the board, they asked me if I would do it because they didn't think they could, you know, handle it emotionally and get through it. So it fell to me, the professional actor and not professional but experienced writer, to do the eulogy. And it was a little different from my grandfather's, because my grandfather's I sort of put together all on my own. But this one, everybody had stories about my grandmother. They wanted, you know, memories they wanted to touch on, you know, because a couple of them had written eulogies that they just decided they couldn't deliver. So I wound up taking all of these thoughts and things and constructing, you know, 1 6-minute speech about my grandmother, and I got through it without cracking until I got to the end of it, which were my particular thoughts about my grandmother, because she was a housewife, she was a homemaker, and you know, from that generation where that's how it worked. But she did quite and raised 4 kids, you know, had a great home, and and as far as a grandmother, she was just a classic sitcom grandma, sweet and spoiled the grandkids and all that. So when I got to the end of the eulogy, I basically, my thought was that, you know, she left behind great people. I mean, my family, they're good people. I said basically that there's no greater legacy, there's no greater gift that you can give to the world than good people. And when I said that, that's when I started getting emotional. It was a good experience, and everybody was you know, grateful that I you know, took the reins on that and did it. Although it was weird to be, because she was Catholic, and we had the funeral mass in the Catholic church that I used to go to, because we had a summer house in the town where she lived, and you know, during the summers, that's where we would go to church. So it was odd to be back in church. It's been a long time. This is the issue that happens when you're a lapsed Catholic, is you go back to Catholic church and everybody goes up and they get the communion. Now, technically, you're not supposed to get communion if you're either not baptized and part of the Catholic church, or if you're not in good standing with the Lord, which technically I suppose I'm not, because I don't go to church. And my sister, who gave up Catholicism, and her husband did not go up and get communion. My brother did, although he doesn't go to church anymore, as far as I know. And I had to do this eulogy in the church with the priest and the nun. and everything, and the altar boy who was a 60-year-old man, so I guess he's an altar man. I don't know what they call that. But anyway, I felt compelled to go get communion, and you know, it's the wafers still taste terrible, but I did it, so I selfishly could feel less awkward walking up onto the altar to stand behind a podium and deliver a eulogy, and I imagine that even though I had no plans of taking communion again, I imagine that is actually the last time that I don't know why else I would be in a Catholic church and feel compelled to get communion. Because I don't think I'll be delivering any more eulogies in Catholic churches for the rest of my days. Because even my mother doesn't attend Catholic church anymore. So, I mean, who knows? But I if I'm not eulogizing, I doubt I will get communion. So that may have been the last time, which is weird to think about. And it may also because my grandmother was sort of the last person in the family that kept us connected to the town she lived in, which was Ware, Massachusetts, where I had that summer home. And I used to spend summers there when I was a kid. And we don't have the summer home anymore, obviously. And my dad pointed out as I was leaving that it was the end of an era. And I realized driving out of town and I was seeing all these landmarks, the pool, the town pool where I had swim lessons, and the farm that still sells corn during the summers, where we go buy corn for corn on the cob for our barbecues, and the road near that farm that led down to the lake where we had the little summer home. And I was driving through all that, I was like, I think my dad's right. I think this is the end of an era, because there will be nothing that pulls me back into that town, because my grandmother was living with my uncle, but now that she's gone, he's plans on moving out of Ware, and so there will be no family in Ware anymore. So if I go to Ware, it'll be something that I do pointedly and go out of my way to do. I want to see what Ware is like now. It's been a long time, but I will never set foot in that town again as someone whose roots are connected there. This is my auto clinic calling. Hang on one sec. Hello? Hey, how's it going, man? All right, cool. Thank you very much. I'll see you soon. So, yeah, what gave me the time to sit here and do this and tell you that kind of sad story at the end there was that my Civic, the maintenance light was flashing and I needed to get an oil change and all that, and the car is fine, it's ready, it's be a small bill. That's a happy thing. But yeah, that's it. That's what I did with my summer break, and now the wife and kid are back in school, so I can do the Toncast again and tell you about what's going on with me, and maybe get some hosts in here. I have TV's Mr. Neil, who I've mentioned before on this podcast, and I are going to try. He lives elsewhere. I've never actually met him in person, but we're going to try and Skype a thing. And he's going to do the post production and cut it together, he says. So yeah, awesome. So hopefully the next episode will be with him. If not, maybe somebody else. I'll see what I can do. I'll see you later. And this has been the Toncast. Thanks for listening, you guy. Thanks. Toncast.